This is Crossroads with Terry Mattingly, a Rational Sheep podcast.
A headline in the New York Times around Dallas. The church scandals seem to have no end. In this part of Texas, a pastor with a clean reputation is not to be taken for granted. Well, it's true. I think it's 17 and counting in that area of pastors leaving the ministry, or at least temporarily leaving their church because of sex scandals or rumor thereof. What's the story really about? Greetings and welcome to Crossroads with Terry Mattingly. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. Terry is Senior Fellow on Communications and Culture at St. Constantine College in Houston, Texas. He writes Rational Sheep, a Substack newsletter for faith and mass media. He's author of the National On Religion column for the Andrews McMeel Universal Syndicate, and for two decades he led the GetReligion.org website. Terry, welcome back.
Glad to be here.
There's really nothing new about pastors falling into sin. What are the unique angles that reporters need to look for in these stories today?
Well, you know, before we get to that, let me address something that was in your introduction. I think one of the keys to this story is not just the topic itself, which is valid and incredibly important, which is kind of breakdowns in the moral lives of powerful ministers. I think another thing that needs to be acknowledged here is the story is also the result of the New York Times deciding to post one of its best reporters in the middle of the United States instead of leaving them in New York, which means you tend to notice that a story like this is happening in Dallas when you have a reporter who is based in Dallas and is getting lots and lots of phone calls. Now, we're used to having that with reporters in Washington, D.C., right? The all-powerful Washington Bureau. And in the days before, oh, the advertising crisis cut so many dollars out of budgets, newspapers had fairly healthy bureaus in places like London and Moscow and maybe Paris and like that. And you had reporters there who got to know the local culture. Well, to some degree, this story is almost more like a local story about Dallas instead of a national story about a crisis in pastoral leadership. And we can work it through later, but I think the two main things that are missing in this story, one is more of a national context. And the second is what I believe, as someone who's been covering the ministerial crises, breakdowns, et cetera, for three or four decades, I think they needed to realize how many of these crises grow out of two factors. And one of them is workaholism. And the other is counseling, is pastoral counseling. And my authority on that is someone I got to spend some time with at a crucial point in my career. And that's a man named Dr. Lewis McBurney, who died about 15 years ago. And Lewis McBurney was a trailblazer in doing Mayo Clinic level therapy and psychology with ministers. Yet he was also a fervent evangelical at the absolute top of both his professional game, but also a man of very, very deep faith who dedicated his life to trying to help ministers put their lives and their marriages back together. And he once told me that everyone thinks that clergy stress is primarily about sexuality. And he said, it's true that out of the cases I've handled, and he worked at a retreat center where they never disclosed the location. I got to visit it. It was in the mountains of Colorado because it was crucial for pastors to be able to say, oh, me and the wife are just going off to spend 2 weeks in Colorado. Nobody would think twice about that, except they were going to a retreat center in an attempt to save their marriage, or their minds, or their souls, or all of the above. But McBurney said that out of his entire career, he wrote a book specifically on counseling clergy crisis. And he said out of his entire career, he estimated that 95 to 98% of the cases he handled involved sexual sin and infidelity. He said, but out of his entire decades of work as a counselor with ministers, he felt that only in four or five cases that he handled was the infidelity the actual crisis. And he said, more often than not, the actual crisis was workaholism and the belief that they were immortal and could just burn the candle at both ends and jump up and down in the wax and get away with it. He said these guys were working themselves to death, and at some point they cracked. And so we'll come back to it later if you want to, if you have questions about that. But I think workaholism and counseling are the two things that should be in this story in art.
I found it interesting that the story kind of opens with a very prominent pastor, Ed Young, approaching his congregation saying, I've been faithful. My wife has been faithful.
Yeah.
It's a compelling opening for a story about pastoral unfaithfulness.
And to some degree, it raises a point that I heard about from readers, of people emailed me about this, and I also saw a lot of chatter on social media. The story mentions the Billy Graham rule, the famous Billy Graham rules for his team, one of which is that they would never do anything in the presence of a woman alone who was not their wife. That if Billy Graham was doing anything with another woman, someone else would be present, another female from his staff, or something else like that. I also remember variations on the Billy Graham rule that kind of swept through the world of Christian colleges and universities during the Me Too era, when people were paying, justifiably so, more attention on sexual abuse. And professors like myself went to all kinds of seminars and classes on how to be careful and how to not get accused of impropriety. And we all called it the door wide open rule. You know, when you met with female students or female colleagues or whatever, the door to your office was supposed to be wide open. So this is another set. The Billy Graham rule is something that is never going to go out of style, because for many very powerful pastors, this is just like the only thing they can think of as a way to fight this situation. And the well-known president of Southern Baptist Theological Seminary in Louisville, Kentucky, Albert Mohler, did a really gripping sermon to the student body after the fall of Pastor Larson. It's Lawson in Dallas, not Larson, it's Lawson. Anyway, he did this really gripping sermon where he talked about knowing this man very well, a close friend of the seminary, someone who had spoken in that same pulpit. And at the end of it, Mohler never broke down. He kept his composure. But at the end of the sermon, he finally said, I just don't know anything we can do except never allow ourselves to be alone in a situation with a woman where anyone might question it under any circumstances at all. No matter how safe the encounter, whatever, you just can't take the risk. And in massive megachurches, people that, I don't think calling them feminist is fair, but people who say what this does, if you enforce the Billy Graham rules, it means that women have almost no way that they can climb in the structures of these organizations without some ability to be able to have candid, forthright, solitary, one-on-one conversations with mentors, their bosses, or anyone else. And that's a serious issue, and it's worth alluding to. I want to read one other thing that I think gets to the point of what I think is the best thing about this story, which is its focus on megachurches, independent, non-denominational megachurches. There are exceptions to the rule, but many of these scandals occur in that context. And you end up with language like this, and this is very good. There's no clear pattern to the scandals, which range widely. The churches are all Protestant, but belong to different denominations or none at all, and have different theological beliefs and worship styles. But the cumulative impact has been unsettling for many Christians and their leaders in Dallas, a city that the magazine Christianity Today once declared the new capital of evangelicalism. And there's 6,500 houses of worship in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, the largest concentration in the top 10 largest urban areas in America. So this part of the story, the Dallas focus, is really strong. and quite well done. But notice, did anyone else flinch when you said that all the churches are all Protestant but belong to different denominations? Well, that's true of the 15 or 16 here. But doesn't that leave some rather major stories from American life out of the picture, like the Roman Catholic Church, you know, still involved in an ongoing crisis that dates back to the 80s, the 1980s, which was essentially with clergy sexual abuse? There have been incredible scandals in the world of liberal Protestantism as well, some of which, frankly, have been covered up. I mean, so I called up today just to see how much of it overlapped. I did a post for Get Religion back in 2016 about the raging sexual abuse scandals in the world of Bikram yoga, that these incredible situations where you have kind of yoga gurus who spend so much time working with women, and how the scandals in that form of yoga really look like the scandals in Protestant megachurches. So this is not new. It's broader than Dallas, but I think it was worthwhile to do a story just about Dallas. I just wish the story had two or three extra paragraphs.
So, Terry, I want to stay on the angle of the megachurch. I would have liked to have seen Graham contact somebody at the Hartford Institute, Scott Thuma or someone like that, experts on the megachurch phenomenon, who've been studying it now for three decades or four decades, and ask the question, how does this happen at a megachurch, or why does this happen at these big megachurches where the pastor's literally always in the spotlight, but is often isolated from his congregation organizationally?
That's absolutely true. I don't know if it still exists, but for several decades, there was a center at a Southern Baptist university in Missouri dedicated totally to studying the megachurch phenomena. And they started their work in like the 1960s and 70s. So, I mean, there was a whole lot of context to what they had learned. But I think if you were to sum up a lot of what these experts have found, it comes down to a very real question. What are these men doing? What is their job? I mean, you could make a strong case. I mean, we call them pastors. You know, we had another pastor fall. In Texas, you often hear these people referred to as preachers. Like, hey, preacher, where are you going? My father, for example, would always say, I'm not a preacher, I'm a pastor. Well, if you have 10,000 members in your church, to what extent are you a pastor? So I think the role that needed to be explored in this story was the degree to which these men are celebrities and skilled performers in a very specific art form of oral communication, which is preaching. Because without the pulpit, and now a pulpit that fits into frequently worship services that are multimedia spectaculars with rock bands, visual art, every conceivable kind of tool of, I would say, entertainment, what is this man's job? Is he a pastor or is he a performer? In some sense, even a multimedia performer. I mean, you know, you take away the pulpit and they're walking around with microphones on like they're on Broadway, and they're wearing khakis and running shoes and a Hawaiian shirt, and there's a rock band behind them, and kind of like in the Black tradition where you have bands that interact with the pastor during the sermon with musical cues and big swells of sound. I think you've got a kind of a white suburban version of that in many of these megachurches. So are they pastors? And I'm sure Hartford and I'm sure other places in America could have got you statistics on what these men actually do for a living. And then what is the structure of the church around them? But when this person is standing, well, I guess they're not standing in a pulpit because the pulpit's gone in many cases. They're standing up there performing, and you can make a case that the entire success, growth, and financial stability of that congregation of 2,000, 4,000, 8,000, 10,000 members depends on the skill of that one man. Now, who is going to have accountability over him? Especially if it's an independent church where the pastor probably is in charge of picking the, it may be called a board of elders, which sounds Presbyterian or something like that. But in reality, it's the board. And in many of these churches, you don't get on the board without the pastor. And who does the pastor, preacher, CEO, who does he answer to? In an independent church, nobody. And then the Southern Baptist Convention, where you have some regional, state, and national structures, they're in the midst of a huge scandal right now over sexual abuse that boils down to the fact that in Southern Baptist polity, there is no bishop. There is no presbytery. There is nobody that these men, 99% of the time, that these men are accountable to. Southern Baptists are a convention, not a denomination. And the local church is supposed to be totally independent and autonomous. So once again, who is responsible for the pastor? And if the pastor commits crimes, who tells the board of deacons at the church, you have to report this to the police? You have to do the following to seek justice in this case, in the lives of the women or men or children or teens that are involved in this scandal. Who's in charge? It's a very, very good angle. But, and I'll mention one other thing I mentioned earlier. McBurney stressed that maybe not in the lives of megachurches, because the pastor's probably too busy being a CEO, but in many American churches, pastors, beginning about the late 70s, began doing everything but hanging out a shingle and calling themselves counselors, that you would go to your pastor for pastoral counseling. And the problem that McBurney put his finger on was that you got these guys, they're perfectionists, they're workaholics, their performance in the pulpit is incredibly important, and now you expect them behind a closed door to do some sort of professional counseling. They may not be trained at all at the psychological level. They may have had one course at seminary or read a series of books, and, or they just believe that all they need is Jesus to guide them and they can be the perfect counselor. McBurney summed it up once in a column, a tribute when McBurney died. And here's that paragraph. Ministers may spend up to half their office hours counseling. Half, which can be risky since most ministers are men and most active church members are women. If a woman bears her soul and her pastor responds by sharing his own personal pain, the result, McBurney said, quote, can be as destructive and decisive as reaching for a zipper, unquote. That's just about as blunt as you can get it. But the percentage of these scandals that are caused by something called counseling is very, very high. And I'm sure that would have shown up in the think tank that you were mentioning and the other resources that journalists need to study to understand the dynamics in these churches.
With only a minute here, Terry, another thing that could have been useful was a conversation with a prominent megachurch pastor on how they avoid this. Or call up Rick Warren and he'll answer the phone for Ruth Graham and say, you've ended your career as a megachurch pastor, very much in the world spotlight. How did you avoid the scandal that has taken in so many just like you? 1 minute.
Well, I know one of them is that in counseling, the late Vernon Grounds, one of the founders of the pastoral counseling movement, he ended up telling pastors, you can't handle this. Meet with someone 3 times, never more than 3 times, and then refer them to a professional. And I think you'll find now that lots of churches have professional relationships with genuine Christian counseling centers to take a lot of this burden off their pastors. But the flip side of what you're saying, I'd love to hear what these pastors would say other than the Billy Graham rules. In other words, if the Billy Graham rules are not what we need today, then what are the rules that you're supposed to follow? And that would be totally worth a sequel to the story, worthy of whatever newsroom wants to take it on.
Terry Mattingly is Senior Fellow on Communications and Culture at St. Constantine College in Houston, Texas. He writes Rational Sheep, a Substack newsletter for faith and mass media. He's author of the National On Religion column for the Andrews McNeil Universal Syndicate. And for two decades, he led the GetReligion.org website. Terry, thank you.
Glad to be here.
I'm Todd Wilkin. I'll talk with you next week. Thanks for listening to Crossroads with Terry Mattingly.
You've been listening to Crossroads with Terry Mattingly, a Rational Sheep podcast.